to lose my mind.
That's good, isn't it?
It's amazing. Yeah, I think that was really great. Well done, John.
I think the grapevine and bass line is an amazing switch as well. I heard it through the bass line. That's well done.
Nice one.
Well done, the Slits.
No, I thought that was fantastic.
John Peel said that they epitomised punk because they were about 15 when they started and they had literally no idea how to play their instruments. It's not like they played them badly, they just didn't know what a chord was. It's
kind of like idiot savants, except they without the savant.
I don't know how to play instruments. I'm not an idiot. Oh, yeah. No, I am. They're unconnected, though.
You would be if you started releasing records, though, John, wouldn't you? No, you wouldn't. You'd be very brave. So, who have we got on, anyway, John?
We've got John Ronson, who's one of our favourite writers. He agreed to talk to us, too.
A Sony Award-nominated journalist who was behind the Men Who Stare at Goats. He has interviewed everyone from Justin Bieber to the Insane Clown Posse. He also just had a piece in The Guardian on Friday, a really great piece about...
Saturday.
Well, all right, John.
I think you know so much. All our life can be tough, all our time can be slow.
Molly Naylor has tweeted in with, I think, with an apposite and honest tweet. Can you do something we can get involved in, like the biscuit debate? Don't really care what you ask, Ronson.
Oh, the infamous biscuit debate. That was when we were at our best. We're all always going to be talking about that.
Man, so this is, but that's. I mean, it's lovely that you've poo-pooed our main guest. I'm pretty sure you'll be eating those words and crying into your bunched fists and rocking.
She didn't poo-poo our main guest, she poo-pooed us.
Oh, yeah. It's a place I know, and it's called the Tillman Chop Show. I always wanted to do on stage a cover of Mr. Bojangles, the track about the kind of like faded dancer and performer. You know, they call him Mr. Bojangles, and he ends up like a drunk in a kind of like cell, but it being about the kind of. It being about the fall of Mark Little. Because, like, he always seemed like quite a sad character in England after he wasn't on Neighbours anymore. And I just thought it'd be funny for there to be a song about they call him Mr. Joe Mangle.
My sister went to Australia a few weeks ago and there's photos of her on Facebook at Ramsey Street. I was seething with jealousy. I've never been so jealous of anyone for anything.
When I went to Australia at the beginning of September, there were suggestions of going on the Neighbours tour, and I was like,
you
I don't...
fool.
Yeah. No, I really didn't want to. It made me feel icky. I'll tell you what, I have got MP3s of his very serious protest song music. It
really?
Is absolutely rubbish. Also,
he's got a version of that he did for British Gas, which is a cover of Jumping Jack Flash by the Rolling Stones. But he's singing, "Careful, be careful of the gas." It's terrifying. He seems like a nice man, though.
He does seem like a nice man, but I wish he'd stop.
I've heard him interviewed a few times, and I don't think any actor enjoys playing their character as much as Dr. Carl, aka Alan Fletcher. He loves it. He lives every moment he is Dr. Carl. He goes on lots of fan conventions and he's often at the Neighbours tour and he does lots of gigs. He's done gigs at UEA as Dr. Carl. And first when I heard that...
he's done lots of gigs at UEA at Dr. Carl, therefore he loves his... I think that shows that someone is... That's like indentured servitude, surely.
I think it's good. It's what people want to see.
It's what people want to see, but it's not like what you dream of when you're going to acting school.
Happiness.
No, thank you. This is the XX with Crystallized. They've arranged to do a sort of special tribute show of Jim Will Fix It.
Who's they?
Who's they? the shadowy cabal controlling sort of like...
British light entertainment.
There's going to be a special Jim will fix it.
There's going to be a special presented. You know what? It can't be. You don't know what you're saying. It can't be presented by Jimmy Savile. He's dead, Tim. He's dead. He's underground. You can't bring him back. Get over it. I am over it. I actually recovered from the loss of Jimmy Savile very quickly. I mourned and then I moved on and I accepted his death. But he's been replaced by it's not a laughing situation, John. Who is presenting the show?
Probably someone called Jim, hopefully.
You think
Jim Robinson.
Jim Robinson. It's not his real name, mate. It'd be demeaning. He'd have to do the whole thing in character with one leg. Does he really have... Jim Robinson. Yeah, anyway. No, Jim Robinson.
Paul
Robinson. That was Paul Robinson. Jim Robinson had a heart attack and collapsed.
Yeah.
And then came back in 24.
Yeah, and
the OU.
And in everything. And like, he was in
as an American.
He was in the R as well.
He's not American. Mental. Anyway, Shane Ritchie is the answer. Shane Ritchie is going to present Jim.
He's not called Jim.
Just on what Jim level Ritchie. Does any of that work? Like, some of you will know that I've gotten a bit of an obsession
Jimmy
with
Hill.
Shane Ritchie. Shane Ritchie having been lined up to open for Michael Jackson at his run of O2 Arena. I was going to call it the OU Arena, which would be just like you go there and start doing lectures on a whiteboard about biology.
The OU Arena is not as cool.
There's a lot more hair and glasses and
you
brown
get
trousers.
Michael McIntyre getting lots of lols there.
He could play anywhere. Michael McIntyre, he's really funny. Look at all his shows; always gets laughs wherever he goes. You need to go anyway. Shane Ritchie is presenting the that doesn't even work.
On
like,
telly,
were they really
on telly.
Tired? Yeah, on telly. Yeah, but I remembered that when Jim Will Fix It was on TV, my grandma was always telling me that she wanted me to write in and say, could she go and have a flight with the Red Arrows?
You could have come and stayed with me. That's near my house. Red Arrows, RAF Scampton.
I thought you were saying that's what I could have written into Jim. Say, hi, I don't know him, but could I go and stay with a guy called John Osborne? And it wouldn't have made... What I realised afterwards is I wanted to write in like a really selfish letter saying, I want loads of chocolate and money. And then I was just like... And now I realise what they wanted was stuff that made good TV.
Yeah, not just to make one person happy.
Jim. And also, I don't think Jim... I think they probably had a production team. But what? Because look...
What?
It's not true! Look,
I've kept that quiet.
Basically, we're trying to have something that you guys can join in with.
Jimmy Hill.
It would be really, really... Jimmy Hill presenting Jim Will Fix
Jimmy,
It.
Jimmy Hill will fix it.
Jimmy Hill...
That's a missed opportunity.
Well, you're a missed opportunity.
I think we should get people to... Well, ask people to email and tweet in...
What they wanted Jim to...
Which Jim should have presented Jim Will Fix It.
John, that's not
Ritchie.
A good topic. Well, yeah, all right. You can message in
topic.
With, like, who you think
favorite,
should present it...
Favourite
instead
Jim.
Of Shane Ritchie. Favourite Jim. Shut up, John. But if you also... If you ever want... No. That, of course, was a chiptune cover of Aerodynamic by Daft Punk, which I just put on to annoy John because I know he doesn't like him. So we've got our show guest on the line, haven't we, John?
Hello, are you there, John?
Yeah, I am. How are you?
Hello, I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right, thank you.
Thank you for doing this. It's very good of you to give up your time.
You.
Oh, have you got nothing better to do?
No, I've got better things to do. It's a measure of the regard I hold you in that I put the better things to do aside.
Oh, that's very unwise.
Yeah. So what, you're in Norwich?
Yeah, this is it's Future Radio. It's a community radio station, and me and Tim Clare.
I heard a kind of like, was that like a little sigh of disappointment in
No, I'm kind of imagining you like North Norfolk Digital.
This is the spectre that hangs over us constantly. we feel the kind of icy tendrils of a partridge upon our shoulders every time we speak.
It's like North Norfolk Digital, but with two Alan Partridges.
double the joy.
Yeah, so where are you now? Are you at home or in your office?
Yeah, I'm in my bath. I was actually, while Kraftwerk were having a nervous breakdown, I took the opportunity to clean my teeth, and I've actually got a mouthful of toothpaste. Would you allow me to quickly gargle?
Yeah, absolutely. This is Radio Gold.
Yes. That's exclusive.
What brand of toothpaste do you use?
I was using Oral-B.
Oral-B, okay.
Yeah, Pro Expert.
Wow. I didn't know who it was. Wow, I suppose there's ways of cleaning teeth. I've never been a floss man at all.
Really? I'm not as much a floss man as I ought to be. I recognise it was unprofessional that I was cleaning my teeth in the seconds before you were about to introduce me. It was bound to fail. Yeah.
To blow up in your face so yeah. colossally, yeah.
Yeah.
So what are you up to? What are you working on at the moment? What's your thing?
Well, I've just come back from investigating a woman who vanished from a Disney cruise.
Yes.
So I'm just back from that a couple of days. So I was on a Disney cruise for 7 days, sidling up to crew members, asking them what they knew about the missing woman, which was quite, you know, on the one hand, sort of stressful, and on the other hand, I suppose, quite invigorating.
Yeah, it's a fascinating article. It was in this weekend's Guardian.
Yeah.
And so how do you feel when you go on things like that? Is that something that you look forward to because you can get a story, or is it slightly nerve-wracking as a...
No, I find it nerve-wracking and anxiety-inducing. My problem is that the only sort of writing I'm interested in is storytelling, but I'm incapable of making stories up, so I have to go off on these adventures to write about them. But I'm not the sort of person who enjoys putting themselves in difficult or dangerous situations. So really, the adventures are the kind of painful thing that I have to go through to make the writing work.
It kind of strikes me that sort of either by design or by accident, you've kind of reversed into the role of a kind of hard-boiled detective, kind of like kind of stumbling upon these mysteries and then getting metaphorically beaten up and then waking up somewhere else and getting another sort of, you know, a bit like the dude in The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, and the fact that I'm the worst, you know, personality-wise, I'm the least appropriate person to do that, I suppose, makes the stories, you know, more interesting, because I'm not like, you know, I'm not sort of like those war reporters who get off on the adrenaline, who are always, I think, quite unlikable as characters. So the fact that I actually don't enjoy putting myself in these dangerous situations probably makes the stories better, even if it makes, you know, my quality of life a little bit worse. But I mean, but what am I saying? I mean, I went on a Disney cruise, and it was mysterious, and so I can't be complaining, really.
Yeah, I guess that it begs the question. I think I'm using the wrong term, beg the question, which means you've let the premise assumes it's. It means why do you do it if it makes you feel so anxious? Why put yourself through that if it's something that seems so sort of antithetical to actually what you enjoy doing?
It's because, you know, writing the stories is something I sort of feel compelled to do, actually producing stories.
Do you think if you were better as a novelist or a short story writer, you would never leave the house and just be at your desk writing these beautiful Frantzen-esque novels?
Yes.
Yeah, me too. It'd be good, wouldn't it?
I'd love it. I said that to Nick Hornby's wife quite recently. I said, you know, does he ever get sick of just, you know, staying in his room the whole time, you know, living inside of his mind, and she said, no, if he had his way, he would never leave N5 again.
Yeah.
And I've got to say, I'm getting to an age where I feel the same way.
Do you think is that an ambition, novels or anything like that? Or
well, I just know that I can't do it. I wrote a screenplay this year. Well, for the last 4 years, I've co-written a screenplay based on, well, kind of inspired by being in the Frank Sidebottom Oh Blimey Big Band. And this was the first time I was being, like, forced to make things up. And there was no escaping. I had to do it. Unfortunately, I had two sort of fiction people alongside me. One was Peter Strawn, who wrote the screenplay for Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and also The Men Who Stare at Goats, and the other person is Lenny Abramson, who's directing the film, and I think without them I would have just flailed, you know, like a sort of dying fish, but with them it kind of worked out well, because I got to do the things that I was good at, which is like sort of small sort of dialogue and little sort of human moments, and the big inventive plot twists.
Are we going to be able to see these plot twists? Is this going to come to a...
Yeah, I mean, it's not, you know, no film. I remember when I was making this documentary about Stanley Kubrick, and his lawyer is this kind of old Jewish guy in St. John's Wood, and he said to me, yeah, he said, John, what are you going to remember? No film ever gets made. And so, so it is quite, so no film ever gets made, but it is possible that this one will next year.
Cool. And in terms of your journalism and your writing, who were your influences? Who, certainly when you were starting, who did you really look at? Either journalists or filmmakers or that kind of thing. Who were your big heroes?
Definitely the old, all the old new, the people in the Tom Wolfe book, The New Journalism. So that was people like Gay Talese, who wrote Thy Neighbour's Wife, which is kind of forgotten now, but was a really important book at the time, where basically he spent about 7 years writing about sex, and it culminated in him sort of kind of going native and getting involved in wife swapping parties and so on. So he completely got consumed by his story, and he wrote this book, Thy Neighbour's Wife, about it. So that him and Hudress Thompson and P.J. O'Rourke and Tom Wolfe and all of those people, who sort of realised that the journalist should be part of the story. Not, I don't think, for egotistical reasons, although it sometimes comes over that way, but really because it's like a sort of more honest approach and leads to the potential for storytelling. So that, and Nick Broomfield's documentaries, I was really inspired by him.
Yeah. He appears more and more in them. He sort of starts off as just like a kind of little boom mic, kind of floating like a hairy cloud, and then slowly sort of moves more and more into shot as his films sort of develop.
There's a story that he was making a documentary about Lily Tomlin, and this was back in the days when he was making sort of, traditional fly-in-the-wall objective films. And the stuff that Lily Tomlin apparently was providing on camera was kind of boring. And then when the camera was off, it all became very dramatic. And it was all about her relationship with him and how she didn't trust him. But it was kind of nightmarish. And he got really frustrated that, the really interesting stuff wasn't being captured, because it was kind of stuff about the relationship between the subjects and the author. And so he decided to make films in that way.
His one about Margaret Thatcher is fascinating, isn't it?
He sometimes, sometimes he kind of gets it wrong. Like he made a terrible conspiracy theory film in which he kind of put forward the point of view that Courtney Love had Kurt Cobain murdered.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, which was kind of ridiculous. But other ones of his films, like there's one about the South African leader, Eugene Terre Blanche.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It was incredible. And that's definitely inspired me. And I think Michael Moore's first film, Roger and Me, and Lynn Barber's journalism, went on to write an Education.
One thing, I know this is like the equivalent of asking, an author, so where do you get your ideas? But I just, because you're, I always feel like quite an eclecticist, like the range of stuff. You go from kind of like interviewing insane clown posse to kind of doing this kind of like piece on the Disney cruise that, is quite a kind of serious piece of investigative journalism, albeit with a sort of slightly odd twist. I am basically leading up to like the where do you go, but I kind of imagine you sitting there with kind of like a bank of TVs with sort of ticker tape news streams going across it, and then one thing will catch your eye and you just get your coat and it's like, I've got to go, I've spotted something that needs, how do you, because they seem such a sort of like radically sort of different set of things that you end up tackling. What makes you kind of go out and do it, or is it as much as you just kind of just get commissioned to do it and have to?
I tend to only do stories that I feel sort of passionate about, because if you do a story you feel forced to do, more often than not it's not very good, and that kind of harms you in the long run, and also is no good for anyone. So I tend to only do stories I really want to do. I suppose the thing that kind of combines more, the thing that links, Insane Clown Posse with Psychopath Test, with the woman who disappeared on the Disney cruise, is that in all of the stories there's a kind of sense of mystery. Why why do people behave in the unfathomable ways that they do? And sometimes that's kind of absurd, like in St. Clown Posse announcing that all these years they've been embedding evangelical messages in their rap songs. So sometimes it's kind of silly and funny, and other times it's about why do big corporations, you know, behave in the terrible ways they do, which is where I was heading in my book, The Psychopath Test. And sometimes it's why is the military behaving in the weird way it does, and that's what the Minister of Guts is about. So it's kind of it's always about kind of mysteries in shadowy places, and then how I find them is, you know, it's just frantic, constant, desperate, you know, searching for them. I mean, there's certain places I look where quite often these stories are kind of there, but not always. I mean, there's a place, there's the James Randi organization, this kind of group of skeptics who kind of discuss, you know, they're interested in the same things I'm interested in, and they kind of discuss them, and sometimes I kind of scour their debates. That's what I found in St. Clown Posse, actually. It was a sceptical writer called Rebecca Watson who was talking about that. And then in kind of weird places, I'll tell you what, you're going to be surprised by this, but I'll tell you what's a really good source of stories, even though they're written in quite often as kind of completely objectionable way. It's the Daily Mail.
Okay. Really?
Yeah, they're very...
probably the best newspaper.
I mean, I can't say I've taken too many, but I've probably taken three or four stories in the last sort of 5 years from them, because they're very well-resourced. You know, they've got a big staff, and they're good at finding these stories about human failings. They approach them in a completely different way. They usually want to bash the human who failed, whereas I want to sort of empathise with them. But I find that they are they've got quite a good journalistic team, you know, for spotting these stories.
So you don't feel depressed by doing all these things. You're not like a cop who only sees kind of like crime and murder by kind of like approaching, because I'm quite a big fan. I read a lot of Take a Break, Fate and Fortune and Chat It's Fate, and at first I kind of like took a kind of slightly kind of superior sneering pleasure at the kind of fallibility of humans, and then after a while that kind of fell away and it was just very sad. It was just like, you know, it was essentially a kind of a compendium of working class grief, and quite sort of tragic, and I didn't stop reading. I think I'd kind of like I'd my soul had got a taste for kind of sort of slightly weird Schadenfreude by then. But you don't, I mean, by constantly kind of like looking at these things, I mean, most of the pieces you've got have got like either kind of quite eerie or like slightly disturbing or either sort of tragic slant to them. Do you come away with something positive, or is it just sits in this kind of cavalcade of folly?
Well, I mean, I suppose quite often the most important stories are the tragic ones, because you know, tragedy is often found in significant places. I mean, a good example, I suppose, is the story I've just finished, the Disney Cruise one, where, you know, a woman goes missing. I mean, it's the saddest story you could possibly imagine. Mm. You know, a 24-year-old woman just, you know, vanishes, and her parents, 7 months later, are no closer to finding out what happened, because only one police officer was ever put onto the case, and he was like a guy from the Bahamas, 1,500 miles away, even though the ship was in between Mexico and the USA, and it's registered in Britain, and she was British, so, you know, they think there's a cover-up going on. Now, this is a, you know, I mean, it's a completely tragic story, but if you take the story on, it's possible that you're getting to some kind of important places. You're getting to the possibility of cover-up within the maritime industry, you know, so sort of corporate cover-up. Now, I'm not saying... you know, there's speculation that there was cover-up. I'm not saying that there definitely was. But you get into important areas. So it's like, you know, it's the stories are quite often incredibly sad. And I suppose in all my books, there's death, you know, in them and the Minister of Guts and the Psychopath Test, and the stories of people dying. But, you know, they're sort of stories about important things.
Well, there's one story that I particularly remember from your Radio 4 series, and I do occasionally teaching in universities. I go to radio departments and talk to the people who are doing radio production courses, and I play clips from things like This American Life or Danny Baker or The News Quiz, and Jeff Lloyd as well, who we were both fans of.
Yeah, and me. He was round yesterday.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
How is he?
He's very well, and he's funny.
He's such good company. He's one of my favourite people on radio, and a very nice man. But this is a clip that I play from your Radio 4 show, where, I don't know if you remember, but it was a couple who met on a train abroad.
Yeah, Abdullah Redpath.
Oh, and
that's the name of the man.
Yeah, and he just fall in love. Someone dies on the train. There's some kids messing around. And it's this couple who are strangers, but they just know instantly that there is something about this relationship, and they spend the night together and just they fall in love so quickly and so overwhelmingly. And they go their separate ways the next day and they exchange addresses. And he loses his address book, his hotel room gets stolen, but he's so positive about this relationship. He says, it doesn't matter because she will write to me. She loves me. She said that she loves me. She will write to me. And she did do. She wrote him three letters, but he couldn't return any of the letters because
she didn't put the forwarding address.
and that's where I end the clip. And you can just watch these 18-year-old students, their jaws drop. And go, we didn't know that's how stories ended. They thought it'd be this beautiful, and then something magical happened.
Nothing magical happened, right?
Exactly. So,
I'd say the thing that I'd really like about that story is a kind of weird little thing, but there's a moment when, so they're on the train and they're in love, you know, they've just met each other and you know it's a relationship that's going to last forever. Obviously, we now know that it doesn't. Mm. And then there's these guys messing around on the train. Are they German, the guys, or American? I can't remember.
I think they're American, yeah.
And one of them's messing around near the door of the train. And he's telling me this story. And I say, hang on a minute, you're not going to say that the guy fell off the train, are you?
And he says, yes.
He said, yeah, I am. And the thing I really like about that is it kind of validates what I don't always do, but I sometimes do, which is deliberately not find out what's going to happen. So basically say to my producer, who then was Lucy Greenwell, don't tell me the details. I want to learn live.
At the same time as the listener.
Yeah, exactly. And I always think of that particular story as an example where that really paid off, because, you know, you can hear the real shock and sadness in my voice. And, you know, and I think that sort of probably affects the way that the audience listen to it.
Yeah, no, it's a great, yeah, it's really interesting. So, finally, just before we let you go, because me and Tim both live in Norwich, have lived here for ages. Have you ever been to Norwich? Are you familiar with
the area? Yeah, many times. Many, many times. I used to holiday in North Norfolk, so I'd go through Norwich, you know, and Holcombe, and all the other, you know, middle-class parents from London go. Holcombe and all those, and Clyde next to the sea, and yeah, I've given talks in Norwich a number of times.
Oh, that's cool.
I'm a great fan of Norwich. Is it kind of sectarian enough that if I mention North Norfolk, the people of Norwich bristle?
I sensed in your voice as you started to speak that you felt you were treading through a minefield of
Delta,
kind of like
Dublin in the 1980s.
Yeah, no, I think we're all actually so parochial that we're actually completely unaware of the existence of other human beings. So it's almost like they're we're not organised enough to have different warring camps, I think.
Okay, that's good. My very first documentary was in East Anglia. It was a film called New York to California, A Great British Odyssey, and it was me and Saul Dibb, who went to college in Norfolk, in Norwich, and he went on to make The Duchess and Bullet Boy and really good movies, and we hired a car, and we basically went on this epic journey from New York, which is, I think, just outside Boston, down to a caravan site near Lowestoft called California. And we made this hour-long film about our activities from New York to California.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for talking to us, John.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much, and I like the sound of the music that you're playing. Are you playing that kind of music deliberately designed to freak people out?
No, we're very lucky here in that, like, Future Radio let me and Tim play kind of pretty much what we want, really. But also, it's a bit like
I think "let" is almost going too far. don't prevent.
Yeah. But the playlist is so good anyway. It's a very kind of indie six music style station, and they let us do things like this once a week, so we're quite.
It sounds good. So it's a bit like Resonance FM in Norwich, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that's great.
Probably not quite as weird at times as Resonance gets. That can be pretty idiosyncratic and bizarre, but this is kind of the right side of weird, I think.
Okay. Well, I really enjoyed it, and now I've got to go back to the next book.
But you don't need to clean your seat. And do you know what you're doing for your next book? Can we get a theme or a kind of area that you're working in?
But it's on its way slowly. I mean, I'm at a stage where it could go off in one of a number of directions, and I'm not totally sure which yet. And I think if one direction, it's about one direction and how. No, if one direction becomes stronger than the other directions, it's quite possible that what I've done up to now might alter. So it's still this kind of weird, sort of organic, mutating thing. I think it might be about the world of crime. And punishment.
Well, if you need any help with your books, give me and Tim a call, and we'll help you out.
I will do it. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Oh, great! Thank you very much, and have a nice day.
And you.
Cool.
And
cheers,
you.
John.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
June. I sing that after songs.